This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, where have all the movers and shakers of the Southern human rights movement gone, and how has their legacy held up in recent years? We'll have a conversation with author and activist Kevin Alexander Gray. And what does it take to keep a grassroots community organization going for almost 40 years in Newark, New Jersey? Veteran organizer Larry Hamm will share his experiences.
But first, the American Civil Liberties Union says the Sheriff's Department in Madison County, Mississippi, has turned the jurisdiction into a constitution-free zone for Black people who are systematically targeted for illegal stops, searches, and arrests. ACLU staff attorney Joshua Tom says the Madison County Sheriff enforces a racial regime that resembles the worst aspects of inner city policing, plus Mississippi style repression.
Yeah, policing, lawsuits, and situations in cities like Baltimore and Ferguson, which are much denser and have more pedestrians. So in those cities, you have a lot of like stop and frisk type activity, but it involves unreasonable searches and seizures. So it involves violations of the Fourth Amendment, police stopping people for no reason other than the color of their skin. And so in Madison County, Mississippi, you have similar unreasonable searches and seizures, but it just happens to be most times when people are in cars, because in Mississippi, everybody drives. It's not a pedestrian-friendly state.
You tell some real horror stories. There seems to be no concept of due process in that town, at least when it comes to Black folks.
Yeah, you know, there's definitely certain parts of Madison County that are predominantly African American, where the Madison County Sheriff's Department has a longstanding policy and practice of just stopping people in their cars or even on the streets, asking for their IDs, searching them, looking in their pockets, maybe asking them to take off their shoes, sometimes cuffing them, searching their cars merely for walking down the street or just driving down the street. It's quite egregious policing tactics that are happening in Madison County.
Is this a longstanding situation, or has there been an uptick in the level of repression on the street?
We have had about a year-long investigation before we filed our suit. We filed our suit in May 9th of 2017. And so during our year-long investigation, this policy and practice of unreasonably searching and seizing Black people in Madison County has been going on for at least as long as the current sheriff has been there, Sheriff Randall Tucker, which is about for the past decade. But also Sheriff Tucker's predecessor, Sheriff Trowbridge, also based on historical evidence, news accounts, and anecdotal evidence, also engaged in the same unconstitutional policing tactics. And if you even go back further, you can go back into the 60s, where there's a notorious sheriff, Billy Noble, and he was known for setting up roadblocks to stop and search and arrest Black people in a very similar fashion as it's happening today. So at least the past decade, if not the past 40 or 50 years.
We know that civil rights organizations and organizations like the ACLU pick their targets carefully to get the most bang for the buck and the most effects out of the legal actions. Madison County, you think, is the place to put the pressure point?
You know, Madison County, based on brief investigation in other parts of the state, anecdotal evidence, et cetera, this lawsuit that we brought against Madison County doesn't seem to be unique to Madison County. I mean, I think that this lawsuit could be brought in other areas potentially. You know, that would obviously take more investigation, but Madison County is important for this suit because it's one of the wealthiest counties in Mississippi. It's predominantly white, and given those two attributes of Madison County, that it's very wealthy and it's very white, is the kind of thing, whereas you bring it against Madison County, it puts all other counties, which are oftentimes smaller and less wealthy, on notice.
You say you're looking to establish a set of standards for the entire United States. What is it about what you're suing for that would set the standard? We see that you're calling for increased training for police and better supervision and monitoring of the cops. We see those kinds of demands being made all over the country.
We're definitely seeking, to the extent that we can get a remedy out of this lawsuit, and it would translate to the rest of the United States, we definitely would love to see that. I think in the first instance, we're trying to get change in Madison County, where, you know, I've mentioned there's been a longstanding decades, if not decades upon decades, policy and practice of treating black people differently. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think in the first instance, we want federal court to say to Madison County and to the sheriff and to all the residents of Madison County and nearby that police cannot stop, search, and arrest you just because you're black. You can't be treated differently by the police just because you're black. You know, so I think that is our first and foremost, that's our main message. But as you mentioned, you know, policies and training, oversight, including potentially a civilian oversight board, some way to make sure that the Madison County Sheriff's Department is held accountable, and to the extent that they continue to do these unconstitutional policing practices, they're held to account and told to stop. Policing is obviously essential to our society. At the same time, for police, following the Constitution is also essential for their jobs.
And what about the powers that be in Madison County? Are they digging in their heels, or do you think the threat of this suit might make them want to negotiate?
You know, it's yet to be seen. They haven't responded to our complaint yet. They actually have until June 29th to respond. Based on some brief press releases from Sheriff Tucker in the Sheriff's Department and also the head of the Board of Supervisors of Madison County, which is sort of the governing body of Madison County, based on very short public statements and press releases, it seems like they're going to defend the suit vigorously. We think it's really important to shine light on the fact that black people in Mississippi, and, you know, this is obviously not a problem that's limited to Mississippi, but that black people in Mississippi are being treated differently by the police in Madison County. And what we're trying to do is get that to stop. You know, everybody should be treated equally by the police. That's what our country is all about.
That was ACLU staff attorney Joshua Tom speaking from Jackson, Mississippi.
Kevin Alexander Gray is an author and veteran activist from Columbia, South Carolina. Gray has gone to a lot of funerals lately with the passing of giants of the Southern human rights movement.
In the last couple of years, I've been just trying to think about what kind of organizing we need to move forward. And in thinking about it, you think about the context of our politics, of our history, where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. And in the last couple of months, a lot of people that have really shaped the politics that I have and given me the political education I have passed. In the month of April and May, I just saw a lot of giants moving to the next realm. Like locally here, we had an NAACP president by the name of Hattie Frewster, lived a long life. And Hattie was one of those local NAACP presidents that challenged the leadership of like a Bill Gibson. Bill Gibson was the NAACP chair back in the 80s with the alliances with the tobacco companies, negotiating with the GOP or the Republicans in the South for black districts. And we opposed just drawing black districts for the sake of black districts in which we would not have any control over those people that were being elected. But in most cases, the NAACP allotted for the slot and the gerrymandering, and that has resulted in what we have now in the South, where the Republican Party is pretty much the white party, the Democratic Party is pretty much the black party. In most state legislatures, you might have a lot of black elected officials representing majority black districts, but in the body at large, they have very little power. And that's where we're left today. You don't have a moderate Republican. You don't have a moderate Democrat. The Democrats are pretty much like Dixiecrats or Republican lights. You don't have an active third party movement. It's just black versus white and black in the minority. And that's what we got from the early gerrymandering. But it was people like Hattie Fruster that challenged what the NAACP was trying to set up for us back in the day. And then there's the passing of Gwen Patton. I mean, if you don't know the history of Gwen Patton, you ought to Google Gwen Patton, because she's big in the civil rights history of the South. Gwen and I worked together with the Southern Rainbow Education Project, which was the grassroots entity that was set up in the South to counter the move by the National Rainbow Coalition to just buy into the Democratic Party and have BEDOs, which Gwen used to call them, black elected Democratic officials, set an agenda that was contrary to a movement agenda. Gwen also worked with people like Jack O'Dell and Ann Braden. Of course, Jack O'Dell worked with the Maritime Workers Union. He was the one that first organized Martin Luther King's first mailing list, the direct mailing list. And, of course, Ann Braden out of Louisville, Kentucky, who was one of the communists that the FBI supposes is now our friend. But she was one of those white folk that filed the lawsuits to challenge these restrictive covenants in the South, whereupon white people could only rent or sell to other white people, which maintained segregation. So I said Gwen passed this week and Hattie Fruster passed, just two giants of civil rights here in the South. But their passing reminds you that the change and the challenge and the organizing has to happen at the local level. No question that the corrupt leadership of this country, from the White House to both houses of Congress, that is evident. The corruption of the two-party system, the corruption of being locked in choosing from column A or column B, but both of them pretty much taste the same. The action and the change has to start on the local level. The pressure has to go up and not down. And that's what I have gotten from the passing of folk like Hattie Fruster and Gwen Patton. When I first got a letter saying that I had been wiretapped, it was a letter, a notice that it went out to Gwen. Gwen was helping organize the Alabama New South Coalition. And this is back during the time of Jesse Jackson's 84 and 88 campaigns. And the first time I had my taste of who Jeff Sessions is back when he was bugging all of us to find out what we were doing. When he filed that lawsuit against Albert King and the folk down in Alabama trying to claim that they were involved in vote fraud because they were registering people to vote, that's the Jeff Sessions I know. But people need to understand the history and the context of where we are, where we've been, and where we're going. And we can figure out some tools to fight back on imperialism and fight back on the challenges to our rights, be it human rights, be it civil rights, and to protect the rights of people worldwide. We have to do that at the local level. We have to understand the total context of our struggle.
You seem to be bemoaning the lack of movement politics, which leaves so-called leadership in the hands of party politics folks.
Well, you know, at this point in time, I might argue that there are no, I mean, there's always politics going on, but we don't have any clear leadership, and that might be a good thing. We don't have anybody that's on the national scene that I'm seeing in mainstream media that's saying anything coherent. I mean, a lot of them just want to be on TV, and they're saying those sound bites that they need to say to stay on TV, and they're smiling and skinning and grinning. And then some of them are just, they're just happy to be there. But as far as what we have to do, I think for the most part, chaos isn't a bad thing, especially if it's keeping people from hurting you. And the fact that we have on the national level in particular, people who are disconnected from the struggle, disconnected from their history, or won't fight to tell that history on the platforms that they're given, well, you know what? Then people see them as frauds or feel that they're frauds, and that's a good thing as we organize on the local level.
Well, we hear more about how evil and manipulative and in our business Russia is than we hear from black supposed leadership in terms of how black folks can move forward.
Well, you hear Russia, Russia, Russia. But the other part of it is a lot of people know America, the United States of America, has no moral authority to talk about anybody interfering in any other nation's business. You can call it regime change, big stick, manifest destiny, whatever. Nobody believes intuitively, or if they're just a casual observer of the news, if they served in Afghanistan or Iraq in particular, if they served in Vietnam, if they served in Korea as veterans, if they watched all the money that has gone down into South America to maintain dictatorships, if they know about America's history in supporting the Somozas or the Baptistas or the Marcos, this whole thing with the Philippines and the American president supporting a dictator isn't new. If they know the history of this country, since World War II, there's an estimated 30 million people have been killed worldwide, directly or indirectly, by the United States of America. If you know that, if you know that 30 or so soldiers are committing suicide every day and you have to go to their funerals, if you know that, whenever you hear Russia, 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 and the Russia interfered in our election, you know that whatever it is that they're saying is nonsense. It's disconnected from reality. It's disconnected from history. If you're a parent and you're raising a kid, you're telling that kid, you know what, karma will catch up with you. If you treat other people bad, it's going to catch up to you. Donald Trump and what's going on in this country is nothing more than what has always gone on in this country. It's just that he's ripped the sheet off of it, and now the whole world sees us for who we really are. So Russia, 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 it's just to keep people from focusing on the fact that we don't have universal health care. We don't have free public education. The roads are crumbling, and we're spending more money on the military, on a military that's protecting a crumbling empire that we need to spend. That's what is going to be the legacy of Donald Trump. That is going to be what I think on the grassroots level creates an opening for some change.
There are some folks who claim that there is a movement abroad. They count the number of demonstrations against Trump and come to that conclusion. But anti-Trump sentiment does not necessarily translate into a movement.
No, it surely doesn't, because movements change the way people live. And movements are not just events. Movements are not just marches. You have to be involved on the local level. You have to change the politics and the attitudes at the city hall, at county council, at state legislatures, in by neighborhood. That's where you have to change the attitudes. It's not on TV. It's not on MSNBC, CNN, or Fox. It's at the local level that change has to happen.
Yes, and if you think that what's wrong with America is Trump, well, you haven't made much of an analysis of what's wrong with America.
Well, everybody talked about Donald Trump dropping 59 bombs on Syria, and nobody talks about the 26,000 bombs that Barack Obama dropped on Syria. Everybody talks about Betsy DeVos being a terrible education secretary promoting charter schools. No one talks about that being Barack Obama's legacy. Everybody talks about the number of people that ICE are violently rounding up right now. Nobody talks about Obama being deporter-in-chief. It's empire. It's not the person that leads the empire. It's the idea that you believe that there are some people that should not have human rights protections, and everybody's worthy of human rights protections. The idea of manifest destiny and trying to create an empire or hold up an empire that just can't stand. It's about trying to maintain a system of unfettered, unregulated capitalism instead of having an agenda where human rights are respected and labor rights are respected and workers' rights are respected, and trying to create a collective instead of competition amongst us all and dog eat dog.
And now we have a situation which I have never witnessed in my entire life, in which people who call themselves progressives are taking at face value statements from the National Security Agency and the CIA and, yes, the FBI.
Well, as I said, the idea of the security state, the deep state, the secret state, and that running everything. Now, no question, it's hard to overcome the bureaucracy. And you have to look at some of this as the bureaucracy. And how do you control the bureaucracy? Which gets back to protecting the fundamental rights, the rights of privacy, and the rights of assembly, just basic kinds of rights. But this idea that we're going to support the deep state when the so-called left is supposed to be against the Patriot Act, supposed to be against the National Defense Authorization Act, supposed to be against the erosion of Fourth Amendment rights. Even now, as it relates to Lieutenant General Flynn, who's claiming the Fifth, well, I might not agree with Flynn's politics, but I support his right to not self-incriminate himself, his right to invoke the Fifth Amendment, and support the Miranda rights against plea deals, because on the local level, on the street level, on the daily level, with a person of color's interaction with the state, which is usually through a police officer, those rights are important. And when they go to the prosecutor who asks them to plea out instead of invoking their rights to trial by jury, if you know, they'll threaten, if you go to a trial, we're going to make it harder. We need to be about supporting rights instead of being knee-jerk and saying, well, since our enemy, especially he's a Republican enemy, is up against the wall, then as a leftist or a progressive, we're going to be supporting him having his rights abridged. No, you defend the rights of the accused to protect the rights of the innocent.
We've just completed a period in which for 8 years there was a black man in the White House, and black folks identified with that black person in that position of power. Do you think that experience has had a real impact on black politics and black perceptions of their relationship to power?
That's not an easy question to answer. I mean, stylistically, Barack Obama made people feel a lot more comfortable than Donald Trump, stylistically. Racial solidarity and racial politics, the same as with white nationalists who support Donald Trump, well, racial solidarity is a strong force and it's going to be hard to overcome, considering most people will accept what they can get as it relates to something being positive in a life that's generally pretty hard. So Barack Obama, Michelle, and their kids, of course they relate to them. It's because of their color. But as I said, if you look at what it is that they left behind structurally or what they changed structurally, outside of a person of color being able to be the face of the empire, because you can look at Trump's Middle Eastern trip and see the response that Trump got in Saudi Arabia and in Israel in particular, well, that was a manifestation of white power and racism and white supremacy, to some respect, saying that regardless of who's in charge of the American empire, if he's black, we're not going to respect that. I think those kinds of things matter, because I look at that and I'm somewhat irritated by the fact that the mainstream media can't even call Saudi Arabia and Israel out on that basic kind of thing as how they dealt with Obama as a human being, a person of color. But when I go back and look at the infrastructure, I mean, I'm not a Democrat, but obviously Obama didn't do anything for the Democratic Party on the local level, and in particular in the South. And then when you look at the things he left structurally, he left the support of charter schools. I come out of the black newspaper tradition, and black newspapers and black media put Barack and Michelle at the top of the fold, which is for us prime space, on the newspapers every week. But when you go back and look at the money that Obama raised, the money that Obama spent, well, he spent it with white boys. He didn't spend it with black media. Black media died during the Obama years. So I don't think structurally that Obama left us anything to work with. Now, what that does is because I do think that people realize it's time to organize. It's giving people a lot of space to start reconsidering other things other than the Democratic Party. I think that is something, if you want to talk about something being positive that he left, I think that people are looking at alternatives to the Democratic Party bailing us out of things, and that we have to have more of a local grassroots focus and skipping beyond Obama. I think they're looking more at the context of the politics, and people are also thinking more ideological. They're actually thinking about collectivism and capitalism and socialism, and I haven't heard many discussions of communism, but the fact that people are discussing alternatives at the grassroots level, even at the street level, and saying that something has to be done that we're not doing now, I think that's a good thing.
Yes, single-payer health care, for example, has had majority support for decades. It has about 85% support among Democrats and 30-something percent support among Republicans, and a majority of House Democrats have endorsed, signed on to John Conyers' single-payer bill, but the National Democratic Party still won't touch single-payer.
Well, you know, a part of what has to happen is that there has to be some education at the grassroots level on what single-payer is, what it means. And I'm not talking about a radio or TV campaign. I'm talking about real grassroots education as to what that is. I had a Green Party candidate who's running in this seat here in South Carolina to replace Mulvaney, Trump's budget director. The guy happens to be a teacher at one of the universities. And he said to me, well, maybe you should have a protest. I said, a protest? What are you going to protest? Well, KU threw out a couple of issues. He said, what if I go door to door? I said, well, you figure in this particular race, it'd be about 40,000 people. Maybe you need to figure out how to reach 40,000 people. And I said, how much money do you have? He said, $1,000. I said, well, that ain't a lot of money. He said, could I go door to door? I said, no, you won't see that many people. I said, but what you could do is what people don't do these days is figure out what your platform is. Figure out a core group of people that you need to get to and put some paper in their hands to educate them as to who you are and what you stand for. That's one of the things that Democratic Party and these big-time campaigns don't do anymore. They'll throw up a lot of money on TV, basically getting white folk rich and other white folk rich. They'll put a lot of money in radio, maybe black radio, 2 weeks before the end of a campaign or time to vote. But they don't educate people in the middle. And a lot of people, you can say universal health care or single payer, they really still don't understand what that means and why it's important that it's passed. And that's a local door-to-door campaign explaining that Obamacare is not health care. It's a health insurance payment plan. And universal single payer health insurance means that the government has decided, and we forced the government to decide, that it's better to invest money in a healthcare system where you don't have to worry about pulling some money out your pocket, that you don't have to worry about going broke, that when you're sick, you can see a doctor and not worried about somebody taking your house or taking your property, or you're not being able to educate your kids, or you're not being able to eat. That's what needs to be explained to the people, and explain to doctors and nurses how they get a paycheck so that they can pay their bills. That's what needs to be explained to the people. I asked my doctor, I said, explain single payer to me. He says, well, that means that all I have to do is send in forms to one place. I don't have to send in forms to the government and to this health insurance company or this health insurance company. I just got to file with one particular entity. He says that sometimes if I don't fill out the paperwork exactly right when I'm filling out paperwork for some health insurance company, they'll reject the claim. The majority of my employees are not nurses. They're people that have to file the claims with these various companies for us to be able to be paid.
And if you can't get an effective movement around something as fundamental as health care, which is life and death, how do we tackle other fundamental issues like housing? and the right to have that?
Well, look, we have to have an organizing plan and some priorities. And at this point in time, because there's such a lack of leadership, there's not a clear picture of the context of our struggle or the priorities of our struggle. And that's what we need to be doing. And for the people that are allies, that have the resources, that's what they need to be providing the resources for. That's where we're at now. You know, as an organizer, I have to say, I think it's a good time to be living. But you have to understand how things go together. You have to build alliances. It has to be a multiracial, multi-issue coalition. People have to understand and respect other people's history. And we got to operate from some common definitions. What is racism? What is white supremacy? What is misogyny? What are human rights? What are the Bill of Rights? Where are we going? What's the context? We ought to have that common perspective of what the battle is.
So do you think that the presence of Trump can be a kind of shock to the psyche that gets people doing that kind of fundamental rethinking?
Trump and Pence and Sessions and Tillerson and all those white men that they want to put on TV all day, every day, and every now and then throw on and the idiot Ben Carson, it has provided a shock to the psyche of this country, how the country thinks the rest of the world views it. And it is a good time to be organizing. But it can't just be about lining up behind Democrats. It can't be that. It got to be lining up behind a set of beliefs and some sort of movement ethos and some sort of vision of where we're going in the future and what's going to be left for our kids and our grandkids.
That was Kevin Alexander Gray, author and veteran activist in Columbia, South Carolina.
For almost two generations, the People's Organization for Progress, POP, has been challenging the powers that be from their base in Newark, New Jersey. POP has been described as one of the foremost grassroots community organizations in the country. Larry Hamm has been chairman of POP since its founding. Last week, POP held its 7th weekly Justice Monday protest at the federal building in Newark.
Justice Mondays is basically a protest that we have at the federal building every Monday to highlight police brutality cases in New Jersey, particularly those that have got little media attention, especially the Jersey Four. We call them the Jersey Four. Abdul Kamal was killed by Irvington police. Jerome Reed was killed by Bridgeton police. Kashad Ashford killed by Lyndhurst police and state troopers. And 4-year-old Radaz Hearns, who was shot 7 times in the back, but survived. He didn't die. So every Monday from 4:30 to 6, we've been in front of the federal building, which houses the United States Attorney for New Jersey's office. And we've been calling for civil rights investigations into the deaths of the first 3 and the shooting of the 4th. But we also use that Justice Monday protest as an opportunity to raise the issue of police brutality as a national issue and highlight and underscore those police brutality cases that happen across the country. And in fact, this past week, we added a name. This happened to be a Jersey case of Elvin Jesus Diaz, whose family for 2 years has been fighting for justice for their son who was killed in their home. So we have these Justice Monday protests to highlight the issue of police brutality in New Jersey, but also nationwide.
So you were already demonstrating every Monday for more than a year before Trump even came into office.
Oh, absolutely. When the Justice Mondays protest started, I don't even think we knew that Donald Trump was going to be a candidate. We've been out there in the rain and the snow and the heat, and it's raining today in Jersey, and we'll be out there in the rain again because we feel it's important to do what we can to keep public attention on the issue of police brutality. Our consensus is, and when I say our, I mean the People's Organization for Progress, is that the issue of police brutality has been pushed back from the public consciousness. It's no longer the headline news, at least not nationally. Now, in different parts of the country, when different cases reach a particular stage, like if a grand jury decides there's no indictment or a jury decides there's no conviction, you know, you hear about particular cases. But at one point, particularly in the aftermath of the death of Michael Brown and Ferguson and then other cases around the country, it was really out there at the forefront. But it's not out there. I think that has a lot to do, of course, with the national election, which ended in November. But certainly the shenanigans of the Trump administration have, like, sucked up all the oxygen in the room. So I think the press has been pretty much focused on that. So in large degree, many people's attention has been focused on Trump. But we have these demonstrations to try to keep public attention on the issue, particularly here in the area where we do our work, which right now is Newark, New Jersey.
Well, it's not just the press. We have noticed that there's been a scaling back of demonstrations by the Black Lives Matter movement.
Well, I can't speak for Black Lives Matter. Now, we have been working with several Black Lives Matter groups here in New Jersey. There's a Black Lives Matter group in Newark connected to the Rutgers campus. There's a Black Lives Matter group in Camden that's been active, and we have had some contact with them. So it's hard for me to speak about them at the local level. They have been, to some degree, active and have had contact with us and worked with us. But you can see nationally, if you just look at the papers, I don't know, you know, sometimes there are demonstrations and the press doesn't cover it. So I'm always reluctant to say, well, there aren't any protests, when I know, in fact, we've been protesting as much as possible here at the local level, and we don't get a lot of press coverage. So sometimes it's a case of the press not covering protests. But what I can say is that in terms of the front pages of the major newspapers in this country, police brutality has not been covered to the degree it was, say, in the aftermath of Michael Brown and Eric Garner and others. So it's up to groups like us at the grassroots level, and there are many groups across the country that are working on the issue of police brutality. We have to keep demonstrating. We have to keep fighting in order to keep public attention on the issue.
Yep. Well, one item that's been in the newspapers is the pending appointment of David Clark, the sheriff of Milwaukee County, who's made
a career
of his open hostility to Black protests.
Yes, and that's in line with the whole attitude and inclination of the Trump administration to, in fact, appoint people who are antithetical to the interests of the Black community. And just because Clark happens to be a person of African descent does not mean he's working in our interests. In fact, he's working in the interests of the Trump administration and the reactionary elements and law enforcement. You know, there's a kind of straight line almost from Donald Trump's campaign. He was campaigning on Make America Great, which we understood meant really Make America White Again. And then he said he was the law and order candidate. And we knew what that meant, put Black folk in their place, back in their place. And then he was endorsed by the Klan, and then endorsed by the 338,000 member Fraternal Order of Police. So the Fraternal Order of Police endorses Trump. Trump gets elected. He appoints the racist, historically racist and reactionary Jeff Sessions as the head of the Justice Department. And the first thing Sessions says is that they're going to move away from monitoring local police departments, that they're not going to enforce, put in place any more consent decrees. And in fact, they're going to try to undo, in their words, review any existing consent decrees. In fact, Sessions tried to go into court to block the consent decree that the Justice Department under Loretta Lynch had put in place earlier, but the judge said no, they were too far down the road, it's too late for the Justice Department to try to come in here and impede the progress, of, if you could say that, in terms of implementing the consent decree. So he appoints Sessions, and now we have Clark, the Department of Homeland Security, who openly voiced not just opposition, but his hostility toward Black protests and toward anyone really calling for significant police reform. And this is par for the course on the Trump administration, and it just means that we're going to have to fight even harder. We can't in any way let these people deter us from the work that we have to do to stop police brutality and police terror in this country. I mean, people don't know that since Michael Brown's murder, 2,500 people have been killed in the United States. I believe it's 2015, 1,136 killed by police. Last year, almost 1,100 killed by police. And so far, more than 400 people have been killed by police this year in this country. And we're not even at the halfway mark yet. So what we have really is an epidemic of police brutality and police murder and police terror in this country. And people like Clark and Sessions are in place to essentially say to police and law enforcement that you guys have free rein. You know, don't worry about these protesters. Don't worry about us trying to interfere with what you're doing.
In Newark, you're part of an effort to establish a Newark version of a police community review board, but it's run into institutional kinds of obstacles.
Yes, and again, it has run into institutional obstacles that are systemic. That is, they're system-related. These obstacles were there before the Trump administration, and they have been compounded by moves by Donald Trump since then. In one night, unprecedented for a president of the United States, in one night, Trump fired 46 U.S. attorneys. Among the 46 was Paul Fishman, the U.S. attorney for New Jersey. Fishman was the U.S. attorney who called for the establishment of a consent decree and federal monitor over the Newark Police Department in response to the outcry and the protests against police brutality in Newark. Fishman called for the consent decree and the federal monitor. The new mayor of Newark, Mayor Ross Baraka, not only agreed with that, but embraced it. And they moved full force to implement, to put that consent decree in place. And what happens, the police associations that represent both rank and file and supervisory level officers have gone into court to block the implementation of a key part of the Newark consent decree, which was civilian oversight of the police. And civilian oversight in the city of Newark took the form of the establishment of a police review board. And we didn't just want any old police review board. We wanted a police review board with subpoena powers. And what happens, the police organizations go into state court to block the implementation of the Newark Police Review Board. In fact, there's an injunction in place right now. It doesn't eliminate the police review board. It just says it cannot go forward with its work until the issue of subpoena power is addressed, because when the police organizations went into court, they went into court claiming that the police review board did not have the authority to have subpoena power, that that had to be conferred by the state of New Jersey. And so they're attempting to block this police review board because it has subpoena power. So we still continue to call for a police review board with subpoena power. We're still continuing our protests against police brutality. The consent decree technically is still in place, and the federal monitor is still in place. However, because Trump removed Paul Fishman and has not appointed a new U.S. attorney for New Jersey or for any other of the 46 jurisdictions where he fired those U.S. attorneys, because there's no one in place, we're not really sure what the fate of this police reform effort is going to be in the city of Newark. But regardless of what happened, we're still going to continue to fight, and we're still going to press for a police review board with subpoena power.
The criminal justice system's only part of the historical oppression of black people. Next month, POP is
holding a demonstration for reparations for slavery and all the other behavior of the United States.
Absolutely. When the People's Organization for Progress was founded in 1983, we're coming up on the 37th anniversary of our organization. When we were founded, reparation was one of the programmatic issues on our agenda at the time that our organization was founded. We believe, as do many other activists in the reparations movement that even preceded the establishment of the People's Organization for Progress, that we talk about the Western Hemisphere, we have to talk about nearly 400 years, or maybe more than 400 years, of labor was stolen from African people. If we're talking about the United States in particular, from the time it was founded, we're talking about 250 years here in this country. But what it amounts to is that billions, if not trillions, of dollars of labor was stolen from African people. And we believe that descendants of black people in this country should be compensated for the stolen labor of their ancestors. We should receive restitution, as have other groups who have been wronged in this country, although they have not received nearly just compensation that they should receive. Some indigenous peoples here in North America have received some compensation, not enough, certainly not a just amount, but they have received some. Japanese Americans received, and this was during the Reagan administration, received some compensation for the internment of their people in concentration camps during World War II. The United States has even been part of reparation settlements that were made pertaining to Jewish people who were used for slave labor in concentration camps in Europe. Now, this didn't even happen in the United States. It happened in Europe. But the United States has financially contributed toward reparations for slave labor of Jewish persons during World War II. So there have been groups that have received reparations. And we say, as we've said for 37 years, that black people should receive reparations for the hundreds of years and trillions of dollars of stolen labor of our ancestors.
Well, certainly the debt to black people has to be in the multiples of trillions. In the year 1850, which was a decade before the Civil War, the value of slaves was greater than any other asset of the United States, except for the land itself.
That's right. Except for the land itself, the largest form of capital in the United States, greater than banking capital and industrial capital combined, was the wealth in the slave industry. And let's not mince words here. It was an industry. We had been commodified under the capitalist system, and our bodies were bought and sold as commodities, just like commodities are bought and sold on the stock exchange now. And the labor that was stolen from our people was used and, in fact, laid the foundation for the United States becoming the wealthiest country in the world today. And one of the ironies of this situation is that at the time of emancipation, people knew this. People in power knew this. They knew that there had to be some compensation, some restitution, some repair to the damage that was done to us. And there was a bill. There had been a military order issued, I believe, by General Sherman, which had confiscated up to about 400,000 acres of land from slave masters. And this was before the Civil War was even over, before Lee had surrendered. 400,000 acres of land had been expropriated from the slave masters. And he actually gave that land to the slaves. A lot of slaves actually got the land and were working the land. And then that General Order 15 became the inspiration to H.R. 29, which I believe was sponsored by the radical Republican Thaddeus Stevens and others, Charles Sumner, Thaddeus Stevens, and others in the Congress. And there was a comparable Senate bill. Now, H.R. 29 itself It did not get passed, but there was a comparable Senate bill that was introduced that did get passed, but was in fact vetoed by President Johnson. So people knew that there had to be some compensation. By the way, H.R. 29 said that every freed person would receive 40 acres and $50. And that's where the 40 acres, basically the 40 acres and a mule comes from. The mule wasn't in the bill. The mule kind of got in there because when Sherman had expropriated that land, sometimes the Union troops would give mules. Because if you had land but you didn't have an ox or a mule or a horse or something to pull the plow, you couldn't do anything with the land. They didn't have John Deere back then, so you had to have something that could pull that plow. So what happened, the mules were used a lot of times to pull the cannons and provisions for the Union soldiers, and sometimes they would give or sell those to the newly emancipated people so that they would have an animal to help work the land. But that's really where the origins of the 40 acres and mule comes from. But the point is this, is that our labor was stolen. Our stolen labor made individuals in this country, as well as the country itself, very wealthy. And we are owed for that contribution to the development of this society. And we must be paid. We must be compensated. And the center of our reparations effort right now is the passage of H.R. 40, which is the Conyers bill, which would seek to establish a commission to both study the issue of reparations, to make recommendations, and to put forward remedies for the damage that has been done to African people over the years as a result of slavery and the other types of oppression that we had to endure, racist oppression that we had to endure in this country.
And where does the New Jersey congressional delegation stand in terms of H.R. 40?
Well, this is a point that has to be raised, and this is some work that we have to do. Congressman Conyers introduced a new version of H.R. 40 into the 2015 and 2017 session of the Congress. And on this latest version, I don't believe there are any members of the New Jersey delegation. So the work of the People's Organization for Progress, and I hope of our allies, will be, certainly I can speak for POP, we will be working to get members of the New Jersey congressional delegation on this bill, to get them to be co-sponsors, particularly in the 10th Congressional District, where the General Assembly of POP meets. We meet in Newark. Newark is a part of the 10th Congressional District, and the congressman from this district, the Donald Payne Sr., who died 2 years ago, he was the first, up until that point, he was the first and only Black congressional representative from New Jersey since the founding of the Republic. There had never been a Black congressional representative from New Jersey. He passed away, and now his son fills that seat. So we will be putting the pressure on Congressman Payne Jr. to become a sponsor. But we're not going to limit it to Payne. We're going to demand that, I mean, there are Black people in every congressional district in the state of New Jersey. So we're going to be demanding, putting that demand on every congressperson from the New Jersey delegation.
Well, of course, President Obama opposed reparations, and you can expect the most vigorous resistance from President Trump.
It almost goes without saying that I'm sure that Trump will resist it. Worse than that, though, is that we anticipate that there'll be resistance even from members of some of the congressional delegations. I'm hoping that there will not be resistance from Congressman Payne Jr., but I certainly could see resistance from other congressional representatives. And we plan to pursue our U.S. senators, two of them, Senators Booker and Menendez. We're going to ask them to sponsor Senate versions of H.R. 40. So we'll see. We'll see how this all unfolds.
And that's it.
for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.